This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. So, it has come down to blue on blue. Italy and France will play for soccer's World Cup tomorrow. A little later on today, Germany and Portugal will play for third place. Joining me now from Berlin is Grant Wall, who has been covering the World Cup for Sports Illustrated and for Only a Game for the past month. Grant, welcome back to the program.
Good to be back.
It's not the final that the home team was hoping for, but how big a deal is today's third place game for the players involved?
Well, I think for the players and for the country in Germany here, there's a lot of pride involved here, national pride that maybe Germans haven't felt very comfortable about showing for a long time, and it's really come out during this tournament in a good way. It's been really amazing to be in stadiums where there are 70,000 Germans waving flags and singing Deutschland über alles. And to see the way they reacted the other night after losing in the semis to Italy was heartbreaking, to be honest, just because you had people in the stands and on the field, the players weeping. And I remember being on the train platform that night, 2 a.m, and there were thousands of Germans there just either quiet or still crying. It was quite a scene.
France was supposed to be too old to win the Cup this time around. The team's most accomplished player, Zinedine Zidane, had retired from international play before the World Cup began, and then, of course, he unretired. What accounts for this team's rejuvenation?
Well, Zidane is a huge part of it. He really seems to have discovered the talent and the stamina that he had 8 years ago when he led France to the World Cup. People thought that he was done, not just with France, but with Real Madrid. He hasn't performed as well the last couple years, but he's going to retire after this game, and I think that knowledge has really helped spur him along here. It's been a lot of fun to watch him.
Italy, of course, has a reputation for playing defensively, patiently waiting for the opportunity to counterattack. But against Germany in the semifinal, the Italians went forward consistently. They created all sorts of chances and then eventually found the back of the net twice in the closing seconds of the final, the second overtime. How will this historically defensive team play against France?
I think they're probably going to play a little more conservatively, just knowing that it's a game that's probably not going to have many goals, as it wasn't the case with Germany. They're probably scared to death to go to penalties against Germany because Germany never loses in penalties.
Right.
It's amazing. France, on the other hand, they don't have that history with, except in 98 they did go out on penalties to them at the World Cup. But I do think Italy is going to be really smart in how they approach this game. It's going to be hot here in Berlin and muggy, and I don't think you're going to see players running back and forth the entire game. I kind of wish they would, because it would be a fun game to watch, but I'm not expecting Italy to put four forwards in at the end of the game like they did the other night.
So who wins the final?
I like Italy, but by a hair. I really think this is an evenly matched game, and I think the odds makers are really confused around the world about who to give an edge to. You see a lot of just pick'em lines up there right now, and I think that's because this France team, we don't know quite what to expect. Is it going to be this world-beating team, Brazil-beating team that we've seen the last couple of games, or is it going to be the team that barely finished second in its first-round group behind Switzerland?
Grant, now that there has been some time to gain perspective on the performance of the U.S. team in Germany, what conclusions can you draw about why Bruce Arena's lads weren't more successful?
Well, they drew into a very hard group, the hardest group of the eight here. At the same time, I don't think you can make too many excuses about refereeing decisions or the group you're in when you only get four shots on goal the entire tournament, which was the lowest of the 32 teams in the World Cup. There just wasn't an attacking mentality there in this tournament that was there 4 years ago when they made the quarterfinals. And at the same time, I think some of the response in the media in the U.S. has been a little extreme, calling for Arena's head, and he may not keep his job, but he didn't turn into an idiot overnight after 8 years of really solid work. And so we'll see what happens now. There's going to be a decision made next week on whether Arena will come back for another four-year term. There's a possibility that Jurgen Klinsmann or perhaps Big Phil Scolari might have an interest in the job or might get it offered to them. So it'll be interesting to watch.
Grant, you spoke earlier about how excited the Germans had been throughout the tournament, but of course Italy beat Germany in the semifinals with those two overtime goals. What's the mood in the country now?
Change a little bit. They've been wonderful hosts here in Germany for nearly 5 weeks now, And I just got to Berlin yesterday, and they're starting to get a little surly, the Germans. That's just my own personal experience, only anecdotal, but people jump in front of you in taxi lines at the train station, and the friendly smile isn't quite as readily available. But in the end, the Germans are very proud of their team. They're proud they put on a good tournament here. Everyone is giving positive reviews to the way it's been organized and the way the transportation is run and all that. And I think that Jurgen Klinsmann, their coach, really captured it well when, after they lost the other night to Italy, he said, "I think we put a new face for Germany out to the world."
Grant Wall covers soccer for Sports Illustrated. He spoke to me from Germany, where he has been following the World Cup. Grant, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, though.
The line-cutting Grant Wall mentions, notwithstanding, the success of the host team in the World Cup has inspired great enthusiasm in German fans. Some in Germany have expressed concern at the reappearance of patriotic trappings in the country that was home to the Third Reich, but others have welcomed the opportunity to show their national colors the way other countries do. From Germany, Kurt Nickisch reports.
When your fatherland is responsible for World War II and the Holocaust, it's hard to do any rah-rah flag-waving. But German coach Jurgen Klinsmann gave his country something to cheer about. He broke with decades of solid but stolid German play by fielding a young, free-flowing team. Their spirited games raised the hopes and the flags of a nation. When Germany scored against Ecuador in the first round, this Munich beer garden erupted in black, red, and yellow, the colors of the German banner. Student Tim Pohlmann was waving one and had more painted on his face and arms.
I never bought a flag before. I don't know why, but I never did it. And now you see the flag on every third or fourth car. It's really nice to see. And so I'm very proud and very excited to see the flags everywhere. Hard to explain in words. A lot of emotion in it.
What makes the flags here on houses and passing Mercedes so remarkable is that before the World Cup, there simply weren't any. Germany's militaristic history means its citizens have distanced themselves from national symbols. Many Germans don't even know the words to their national anthem. Thanks to the World Cup, that's becoming a thing of the past. Each time Germany played, Bild, the country's most read newspaper, published the lyrics on the front page. And when the national squad played Argentina last week, people brought copies to the stadium to sing along. Not every German is singing the same tune. On Berlin's Kudamm, a shopping boulevard that during the Third Reich was lined with Nazi banners, Johannes Pankritz is unnerved.
Wenn ich zur Arbeit gehe, in der Gegend hängen besonders viele Fahnen aus den Balkons.
On my way to work, there are tons of flags hanging from balconies. And somehow that just really annoys me. I even fantasized about taking one of those flags down and tearing it up, but I was afraid someone would catch me and beat me up.
Mich verprügelt oder so.
Pankritz's sentiment is not uncommon for his generation, which grew up in the anti-authoritarian 60s and 70s. He says he never gave the German flag any thought, much less that he ever learned to honor it.
Vielleicht sind Fahnen überhaupt für mich was.
So now it's just really strange for me. If it continues like this, maybe I will get used to seeing so many flags. But certainly, I will never think it's a good thing.
Aber gut finden werde ich's wohl nie.
Does the sea of flags represent a sea change in the nation's demographics? After all, younger Germans no longer carry the weight of World War II like their parents had to, and they're proud of how their country anchors a peaceful Europe today. However, some observers say all this talk of national pride is a bit overblown.
There's a lot of talking about patriotism. I think more it's a thing of pop culture.
Thorsten Teichmann is a journalist with Bavarian Radio who was struck by the attire of some schoolchildren at a Munich museum.
And one girl had a flag around her hips as a skirt. She wears a flag around her bum. So is this really patriotism, or is it something kind of chic, something everyone does right now? I think that's the case.
Even so, Teichmann says the playful way some Germans are displaying the flag shows just how far the country has come since 1945.
It's totally the different thing to imperialism, nationalism in the last century in Europe. It is welcoming people. It's more a sign for a really big party we are celebrating right now here with the World Cup in Germany.
The positive atmosphere here has pleasantly surprised hundreds of thousands of international visitors. Instead of finding the dour rules and regulations they expected, they've been celebrating with fun-loving Germans in stadiums, at beer fests, and open-air screenings. International fans are far outnumbered when Germany plays, though, and not every visitor finds the black, red, and yellow throngs so inviting. Benjamin Bentall is a visiting professor from Israel, teaching at a Berlin university this year.
I do realize that this is quite innocent, and it's just the spontaneous joy of people. On the other hand, of course, there is something that is a little bit frightening about big German masses waving flags. So I must admit, quite mixed feeling about that.
Many Germans share that sentiment and will for some time, but the 2006 World Cup in Germany may well prove a turning point in national and international mindsets. At least Tim Pohlmann hopes that's the case back at the beer garden in Munich.
I think the last 50 years we always was compared with the Second World War, and now I think the world sees Germany in a new way, that the people just want to watch the game, the sports, and be proud of their team. I think the time is right, and perhaps it's the beginning, a new start for the Germans to be proud of the country. Hopefully, hopefully.
Having fallen short of the final, the German national team plays for third against Portugal today, but their inspiring run and stint as friendly hosts have given Germans a piece of their national identity, and that may well be the greater trophy. For Only a Game, I'm Kurt Nickisch in Munich, Germany.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, basketball as the Wranglers, Cornets, and Rockettes played it in Nebraska, Iowa, and Ohio a quarter of a century ago. But first, the sun having set once again on the U.S. tennis landscape, at least as far as Wimbledon is concerned, I'm joined by Bud Collins, who's been covering the Tournament of Tournaments this week in London. Bud, welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks very much. It's been exciting seeing this young Rafael Nadal go to the final. And, you know, he was coming here. He said he might win a couple of more matches, but he's been a very good student of Grass 101.
Well, I want to get back to Nadal in just a moment, Bud. But first of all, the thing that's got everybody worried here in America, for the first time since 1911, there were no Americans in the quarterfinals. Panicked experts have pondered the state of American tennis all week. Is it as gloomy as everybody says it is?
Yeah, it is. It's the ice age setting in for American tennis. It's an interesting thing to look at. I think there is a problem in that there are not enough good athletes playing tennis in the United States. There's competition from other sports, and other sports are cheaper to play. You kid can wander down to the corner, see a basketball hoop, and then he gets a scholarship and he's on his way. It's not that way in tennis. Tennis is an expensive game. You have to travel to play tournaments, and you have to buy expensive equipment. The rackets are out of sight. And so I think there are a lot of problems that have to be ironed out, and maybe the USTA can do it to give scholarships to their training camp to kids. But to get back to the ice age, I think we're in for a bit of a bleak future. Jim Courier always says it's cyclical, and in the past it has been cyclical. But the next cycle, to me, seems a ways off.
But I can't think of a worse women's final for the phonetically challenged, such as myself, than today's match between Justine Henin-Hardin and Amélie Mauresmo. But for tennis fans, it should be fantastic. This is the final everybody wanted to see, right?
Yeah, it is the match people really wanted to see, because I feel that Justine Henin-Hardenne is the best player in the world right now, but Mauresmo may prove differently. Amelia, it's interesting. It's a Charles Dickens story, The Tale of Two Cities for Mauresmo. She comes from Paris. She comes here to play in London. There's no pressure, and she's been terrific in London. She's been in four semifinals, and this is her first final. But take her to Paris, and she can't fight her way out of a paper bag. The nerves get her. I talked to her after she had won over the Siberian siren, Maria Sharapova, and she said, I felt a little nervous going into that third set, but then I realized I was overcoming them for the first time, and that was great news because she's a beautiful player, very nice young woman, and I think it's going to be a marvelous fight with her and Anna Arden.
Mauresmo is the number one seed, but it's her opponent who's considered the favorite. Who do you see holding up the Venus Rosewater dish this afternoon? And boy, do I get points for knowing the name of that trophy, huh?
You certainly do, Bill. I think you should know also they call it's a silver salver, whatever that means.
Whatever that means.
Yeah. I think Anna Arden is going to win. I've picked her from the start, but either one will be a fine champion.
Now let's get back to talking about the men a little bit. Number one seed Roger Federer is unbeatable, or has been, except when he plays Mr. Nadal. The Swiss has lost five straight times to the Spaniard, the latest defeat coming in last month's French Open final. Can Super Federer finally overcome his personal kryptonite?
Well, he ought to, because the location is different. It was clay in Paris, slow clay, and that is what Nadal grew up on. But he has taken to grass. He has taken to it like Juliet, that's Federer's cow. Who is
I remember that story.
Oh, yes, we must not forget Juliet. Anyway, Nadal, in beating Marcos Baghdatis, was just superb. And he will go into the final against Federer, having held serve 80 consecutive games. Yeah. Now, that's just unheard of. So I think that if he could come in here and beat Federer in Federer's backyard, that would be one of the great victories of all time. I'm picking Nadal just to have some fun. Federer should win.
I wonder, Bud, is this one of these rivalries that can go on for years a la Borg-McEnroe?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a very good rivalry. They'll play on clay. They'll play on hard courts. They haven't played indoors as yet. But as you said, Nadal is way ahead in the rivalry, and it's up to Federer, the best player in the game, to catch up.
The great women's champion Martina Navratilova announced that she will retire from tennis again. The 9-time singles titleist ended her Wimbledon career with a mixed doubles loss in the third round. She had wanted that one more title. What can you say about the remarkable 50-year-old that wasn't said the last time she retired, which was, what, 12 years ago?
I don't know. It happens every once in a while. She's not the only athlete to indulge in retirement and find out that it's more fun playing. I suspect she'll play in the U.S. Open, maybe close it out there, as will Andre Agassi. I hope she does. Unfortunately, she lost her mixed doubles partner, who dumped her for Venus Williams, and you can understand that. Venus is a little younger and has longer and quicker legs.
Well, yeah, but it's kind of a shame that it happens in tennis, too, isn't it?
Oh, yes.
Bud Collins covers tennis for the Boston Globe and NBC Sports. Bud, thanks again.
Thank you, Bill.
On Wednesday, the WNBA announced that Tamika Catchings of the Indiana Fever and Sue Bird of the Seattle Storm were the leading vote-getters among the players who will start the league's All-Star Game on July 12th. Catchings, a forward, will be playing in her fifth All-Star Game in 5 years. Bird, a guard, has made three All-Star teams. The Dayton Rockettes and the Houston Angels lasted only a year, but the Milwaukee Does and the St. Louis Streak played for two seasons, and the Minnesota Phillies and Chicago Hustle went the distance. All 3 seasons that the Women's Professional Basketball League existed, 1978 to 1981. In Mad Seasons, Kara Porter presents the first Women's Pro Basketball League in all its quirkiness. She joins me now from KUER in Salt Lake City. Kara Porter, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You mentioned that practices were often held early in the morning or late in the evening so that players could hold down day jobs. But weren't the top stars of the WBL pretty well paid?
In the second and third seasons, there were a couple of players that were well paid. Ann Myers, Nancy Lieberman, Carol Blazejowski, a few of those were well paid, but 95% of the players were making, you know, maybe $10,000 a year if they got paid.
Though some teams lasted only a season and the league was in business for only 3 years, the WBL generated some great moments. I particularly like the story of how the captain of the New Jersey Gems made sure that she would get paid.
Wicked Wanda Zarametta. Yeah, she was a hoot. She lasted all 3 years in the league and played in New Jersey the whole time. But they weren't getting paid one time, and she decided, well, I'm not going to have that. So she went to the owner and said, well, I want to get paid, and that didn't work out. So she went to the door, and as people paid for their tickets, she would just get the cash and put it in her sock until she had her paycheck.
And then she said, okay, now I'll play.
Right.
That's great.
See, that wouldn't have worked for Butch Van Breedekoff since he didn't wear socks.
Yeah, that's what I understand. He was fired because he wore shoes and no socks when he came out to games. They didn't think he was properly dressed as a women's professional basketball coach.
Now, Butch denies that. He says he always wore socks to games. So
not to practices necessarily.
Right.
Mariah Burton Nelson, who played for the San Francisco Pioneers, was told that she was being waved off the team. She was being cut because she wasn't tall enough. And then she pointed out to the coach that she was, in fact, the tallest member of the Pioneers. And the coach said, well, in that case, you're not quick enough. Why was she, in fact, fired?
Well, she believes that she was fired because she had been spotted at a gay rights parade in San Francisco by a reporter that she had sparred with earlier in the summer. And she feels pretty strongly that, you know, the timing of that was pretty suspicious. Plus, the next day when she went to practice, somebody said, well, you got seen at the parade. And then she was waved right after that.
It's interesting that that concern was apparent even then. Was it something that the players had to fend off, in interviews and that sort of thing?
They did. You have to remember back in the late 70s, basketball was not that common or popular even among women and girls, nothing like today. And so back then there was sort of a built-in prejudice that had to be overcome. You know, one of the things that I found most interesting about that league is that, yes, they did have some gay players. They had an awful lot of players, of course, who weren't gay. But they also had a lot of born-again Christians.
Hmm.
It was just an interesting thing. I mean, I can remember at least five or six on one team alone, and yet all the players usually got along quite well.
Writing about the WBL in the Saturday Review, Jonathan Evan Maslow asked, quote, will feminists support their sisters? Was lack of support from female fans the reason the WBL failed?
It was one of the reasons. Lack of money was the main reason that it failed, but they really couldn't figure out who to market it to. You know, one group thought men is the obvious target for this. Another group thought it was women. I think the lack of support from women was a real problem. Men were not really going to support this league, certainly not back in the 70s. But women weren't coming either. I think the difference there is that women didn't go to as many sporting events as we do now.
That's an interesting point because even now, even in much more recent times, a women's pro basketball league has failed and a women's pro soccer league has failed. And the only women's pro basketball league or pro sports league that has endured for as long as 10 years has done so because the NBA has propped it up.
Although I say, what's wrong with that? I mean, you know, support from the NBA, I think, is really a long-term investment for them.
Mm-hmm.
Clear back in the 70s, the NBA recognized that long-term women's basketball, you know, had a lot of potential for growth. There were a number of NBA owners that were interested in teaming up or pairing up with the WBL if it lasted long enough. It's just a matter of being patient. I mean, when you look back and realize that in 1979, there was serious doubt as to whether the NBA was going to be around any longer. They were tape delaying, you know, the NBA title game. you know, give the WNBA some time.
A lot of the former players with whom you spoke said that they were proud of being pioneers. That was the way they characterized their pro basketball experience. To what extent does their experience relate to the circumstances of women playing pro basketball today?
I think today it relates a lot, partly because Donna Orender, who is now the president of the WNBA, played 3 years in the WBL. And we're already seeing some changes in the WNBA that reflect the way that she played. For example, going to quarters, adopting a shot clock. You know, I see some of the same disputes today in the WNBA that I saw back in the WBL times in terms, you know, well, how come there's so many male coaches, or how do we market these players?
I would imagine Donna Orender may feel a certain sympathy to WNBA players today who say, hey, you know, we're not really getting paid enough. She can say, you don't think you're getting paid enough. You should have seen me trying to get paid back there in 1978.
Well, of course, she was exceptionally clever. She went to court and got the small claims court judge to declare her a free agent when she didn't get paid and was able to go to another team. Most players don't have that kind of savvy. I mean, she's in a tough situation now. She's basically management now. And, mm-hmm. you know, when you look back at the WBL, where they would ride in the bus for 8 hours and then play and then ride back for 8 hours, you know, if you're hearing some WNBA player complain about a three-hour layover, you might not be as sympathetic.
Kara Porter is the author of Mad Seasons, the story of the first women's professional basketball league, 1978 to 1981, published by University of Nebraska Press. She spoke with me from the studios of KUER in Salt Lake City. Kara, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Only a Game. Among the emails received at Only a Game this week was a long poem by a listener named Wally Firesteel, who is much given to rhyming. This verse celebrates the baseball game on Independence Day in which the Cleveland Indians beat the New York Yankees 19-1, and I was going to read some of it here in the letters segment, but then I got to the part where Mr. Firesteel rhymed Cabrera with error. And I'm sorry, but there are standards, even in doggerel, so that's just out. Samuel O.J. Spivey, who hears the program on WAMC in Albany, New York, emailed in response to John Kalish's story on last week's program about the Long Island school, where a teacher had modeled part of her curriculum on the Tour de France. The story illustrated what's wrong with American education, Mr. Spivey wrote. The ignorant teacher told the children that €450,000, the Tour de France winner's prize, was worth $400,000, rather than the $576,000 that it's really worth. A lot of the recent mail has had to do with the World Cup. No surprise there, I suppose. Bob Cavanaugh, a WBUR listener, wrote as follows, "Can you explain this headline? Ukraine's penalty kick trounces Tunisia 1-0. No, Mr. Cavanaugh, I can't. Among the other WBUR listeners concentrating on Only a Game's comprehensive soccer coverage was Bryce Platt, who heard me say that over 200 countries were ranked by FIFA in the competition to determine who plays in the World Cup final. The 2006 CIA World Factbook only lists 192 countries. 192 isn't more than 200. Fire your fact checker," he wrote. Mr. Platt is correct. Some of the places that field soccer teams ranked by FIFA are what the 2006 World Factbook calls nations, dependent areas, and other entities. But perhaps these places enjoy being called countries. I hope so. Lou Lasher, a Cambridge, Massachusetts resident, wondered in an email if the presidents of Italy and France have bet on the outcome of the World Cup final, the way governors of U.S. states with teams in the Super Bowl or World Series often do. He pointed out that it would be a good cup for such a wager, since both countries feature such excellent food. Mozzarella versus camembert, spumante versus champagne, prosciutto versus foie gras, and so on. Those are all his suggestions. You can send us your comments at Only a trivia game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.vu.edu, or you can reach us through the website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at cabotcheese.com, and Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting, available at the Implant Dentistry Center at bicon.com, bicon.com. This is NPR, National
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game. Can you canoe? Well, if you're in Hawaii, perhaps you can, and perhaps you are, just as your ancestors did. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Tomorrow's World Cup Championship game will match Italy with France. Have you a pick?
Of course I have a pick, you son of an English pig dog.
You like
you mother of a window dresser.
How can you not like Les Français with Zorro P. Zinfandel, the veteran, playing his last game? I am very much on the French bandwagon, which, oddly enough, moves in reverse.
Meanwhile, the perpetrators of a potentially painful prank have been arrested in Berlin. But tell me, Charlie, if you were walking along a street or a Strasse and you saw a soccer ball and a sign that read, "Can you kick it?" would you do that?
This certainly does explain the losing streak in World Wars, doesn't it? People injured themselves. These two guys made cement soccer balls and left them on the sidewalk and then just sat there and watched people kick them. Now, in the United States, these guys will probably go to jail. In the United States, they get their own series on Comedy Central.
Charlie, now we're going to play that game called Provide a Context. And this week's statement made by Burkhard Jahn, a police spokesperson in Cologne, is football and beer go well together. Football and prostitution are apparently not as great a combination. The context, please.
Apparently. Alas, they built the biggest brothel in the history of Berlin to take advantage of the hundreds of thousands of people who are coming to Germany for the World Cup. But the owners of Artemis, which is the name of this particular little fun factory, was expecting 500 men a day. They've only gotten 250, although that is twice the normal attendance. But they did all this redecorating, and they made it look so nice. Mm. It's really kind of a sad story.
In yet another Wimbledon controversy, it appears that some spectators have tried to sneak in contraband yogurt. Say it isn't so.
Didn't we have the same kind of story about guys wearing shorts sponsored by a beer company during the World Cup that wasn't Budweiser? These sponsorship wars are getting very serious. This woman was 57 years old, Marilyn Still. She's 57 years old. She's a mother of two from Brighton. I have this auditory hallucination of Graham Chapman doing these quotes. But I couldn't believe it. The security guard looked through my bag and took the yogurt off me. She's got low blood sugar, and that's why it's important for her to eat yogurt whenever she wants.
Athletes often retire several times. Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson come to mind, and I don't think they let you become a boxer unless you agree to multiple retirements. But 12 years between retirements, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, Martina Navratilova was shooting for one more title at Wimbledon in the mixed double. She didn't get it, so now she's retired and apparently has informed her, among other things, her doubles partner or former doubles partner that this one's official. So I guess we check back in 2018.
Yeah, somewhere in there. Okay. In the over 70 division. Charlie, the Tour de France, no longer the Tour de Lance, is underway without last year's first, second, third, fourth, and fifth place riders, those last four out due to another doping scandal. This year's Tour is already creating some new stars, but does anybody care?
No, because none of the problem with the Tour de France now in the post-Lance Armstrong era is any poor sod who wins the thing once is a nobody. I mean, if you haven't won the thing three times, people won't even talk to you.
Time for some July NBA talk. It might be too soon to talk of winners and losers in the free agent period, but it seems to me that the Bulls have a pretty good head start, no?
Prying Ben Wallace loose from the Detroit Pistons, where he was a staple of that franchise and staple on two NBA championship teams, kind of passes along the notion that the Bulls are becoming a destination within the NBA again, which they haven't been since the departure, obviously, of Michael Jordan. And the team with two names. The New Orleans Oklahoma City Hornets have managed to pick up Peja Stojakovic and Bobby Jackson, and they traded for Tyson Chandler from the Bulls, which I presume opened up the spot for Ben Wallace. So they're going to give whatever is considered to be their home city a better product next year.
Speaking of Bulls, the tradition of obstreperous Bull mascots lives, eh?
Yeah, the Benny the Bull, actually the guy's name is Barry Anderson, took a punch at a sheriff's deputy.
Oops.
Who knocked off his glasses. He was riding a motorcycle through a street festival without permission, and the off-duty cop tried to stop him. Benny the Bull ran away from him. The officer caught him, probably no surprise there, but Benny the Bull let him have one.
The last two All-Star picks were voted in this week, Charlie. It sounds to me like maybe the public relations staff for the Chicago White Sox deserve a raise.
Yeah, they managed to get A.J. Brzezinski onto the team with launching a Punch A.J. campaign. There were T-shirts. They had a little check mark next to his name, meaning vote for him on the ballot. But if you were to spread those T-shirts around the American League, where A.J. Brzezinski is not the most popular player, you would get a whole different reaction to them, I would think.
One day into the resumption of his baseball career, Jose Canseco got traded. He hadn't already worn out his welcome with the San Diego Surf Dogs.
No. His daughter's going to be living him this summer, and he doesn't want to haul her around to hotels, as he says. He's been traded from the San Diego Surf Dogs to the Long Beach Armada. Those of you who have invested heavily in your Golden Baseball League rotisserie league will adjust accordingly.
In one of the more thoughtful minor league baseball promotions ever, the Bowie Bay Sox, the AA affiliate of the Baltimore Orioles, will provide an allergen-free section of the stands for Monday night's game. So, buy me some soy nuts and tofu snacks. I don't care if I never get
and
back.
There goes, and there goes my joke right out the window. You know, there's been a lot of attention paid to the problems of people with food allergies, especially the people who have anaphylactic reaction to peanuts. So good for the Bowie Bay Sox, and good for you for leaving me absolutely nowhere to go with the question.
I'll try not to do that again. Yesterday saw the beginning of 8 days of the traditional running of bulls in Pamplona, Charlie, and this despite a pre-run demonstration that probably would have left Ernest Hemingway unamused.
Yes, the animal rights activists were running around naked or half-naked or three-quarters naked or substantially naked prior to the race. The animal rights thing on this one I don't get, because this is one of the few activities involving animals and humans where the animals really have a fighting chance. Of course, the animals wind up in the bull ring and they wind up, you know, being butchered and bullfighting. But just for that one shining moment down the streets of Pamplona, they get a shot. I think we should admire them for that.
And finally, Charlie, a bit of an update from the land down under. Australia and New Zealand are apparently on the verge of an international incident after some sort of altercation involving a member of the All Blacks, New Zealand's rugby team, and a handbag, or more than one handbag. What's going on here?
Well, an Aussie television station has gotten creative. As you know, the All Blacks perform the haka, the traditional Maori war dance before everything, which looks a lot like sumo wrestling combined with line dancing. And as kind of a jibe at them, Seven Network Television in Australia digitally dropped a handbag over the shoulders of the people doing the haka. This is, of course, a blatant disrespect for New Zealand's indigenous traditions, and I guarantee you will be responsible for at least one fist fight during the upcoming matches.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me on Only a Game each week. Thanks, Charlie.
And I've never been digitally enhanced.
By 1976, the art of canoe carving and navigation were nearly lost around most of Polynesia. But a group of Hawaiians set out to change that, building the now famous double-hulled canoe Hokulea and successfully sailing it to places like Tahiti and later New Zealand. The result was a revival of history and pride for native Polynesians and the beginning of a new generation of master canoe builders and carvers. Now, 30 years later, those inspired by the voyage are drawn back to Hawaii to say thank you the only way they know how. Jesse Hardman reports.
At the foot of the ocean on Maui's west side, Lahaina Town, old friends are gathering for a special ceremony. A long line of Polynesians are entering Kamehameha Iki Park, a hallowed place for Hawaiian natives. Hawaiian chief Keomoko Kapo is dressed in a yellow loincloth decorated with symbols like sea urchins and shells. Kapo gives each visitor a traditional greeting, which consists of touching nose to nose and gazing directly into the eyes of each guest. If it weren't for some tennis courts and a surf school in the background, it would be easy to imagine oneself in Hawaii's ancient kingdom. At least that's how Kapo sees it.
We try to make sure that we honor our families that come from afar. We haven't rekindled the fires for a long time. So every time we are confronted with each other, it's the mingling of minds within the spirit. It's like playing chess with words, sort of like, where have you been for the past 500 years?
Maui has hosted Polynesian canoe craftsmen and women for the past 9 years as part of the International Festival of Canoes. The goal of the event, says Keumoko Kapo, is to remind the world that native Pacific art and culture is alive and well. The festival visitors are the remaining keepers of a craft, canoe carving, that is central to Polynesian history and a way of life. And Kapo says it's more than just a craft. It's a powerful source of identity.
If you know your genealogy, you need to know three things. The name of your mountain, the name of your river, and the name of your canoe. Once you know those three things, then you know who you are. When these carvers come here and they carve their va'a, their canoe from their place, they're automatically saying, this is who we are.
At this year's festival, Kapo leads a group of 20 Hawaiians in a traditional welcoming ceremony. A group of 50 or so participants from New Zealand, Tahiti, the Cook Islands, Hawaii, and Tonga look on. But as soon as the opening formalities are over, it's time to work. Logs of albizia wood from Hawaii's Big Island are laid out for each team of carvers. The longest, nearly 50 feet, is for a fishing canoe, or waka, as a group of Maori craftsmen from New Zealand call it. The leader of the Maori team is 78-year-old Hector Busby. Busby wipes the sweat from his forehead and sizes up his log. Widely considered the dean of the canoe carving fraternity, Busby is known for his ability to see beauty and functionality in a massive, gnarled piece of wood.
The log, the way it was laying, it looked okay, but after I had another look at it, 4 foot from the top end of the tree, there was a kink. So I decided to roll it over and have that kink coming upwards for the bow.
From sunup to sundown, carvers and their teams saw, hack, and shape their logs using a variety of techniques. Some crews brandish tape measures and other conventional tools. Others conjure a canoe with little more than imagination and chainsaws.
I already saw the canoe the first time I saw the log.
Stephen Feo Feoko leads a team of carvers from the Kingdom of Tonga. The popa, the Tongan word for canoe, is linked to that island's distinction as one of the only countries on Earth not colonized by Europeans. Feo Feoko says popas are no longer made for war, but he says they continue to be used for transportation, fishing, and as a symbol of Tongan community.
You don't really have a home without a canoe. A canoe is like part of the family. So the main hull is representing the father, and the outrigger is the mother. Being joined and connected by the crossbar, which is the kiato. And the kiato is to symbolize the children, the link of the family.
After a week of heavy labor, the canoe hulls are moved down Lahaina's front street to an enormous banyan tree at the center of town. The new venue provides shade for the second phase, sanding, carving, and finishing. The crews work inside areas cordoned off with yellow caution tape as tourists look on, giving the scene the appearance of a living museum. Michael Tavioni, an artist and carver from the Cook Islands, says the public exposure is good, but only if people are educated in the process.
Well, if you happen to walk by and look, I hope you remember that there is a culture intact. Because otherwise, we're just monkeys on show with a halo tag put around us. And people come and look at us as if we are in a circus or something.
Tavioni points out that most of the fully functional canoes constructed during the festival end up on display in the hotels and restaurants of the event's corporate sponsors. A walk around town shows canoes in various states of disrepair. Tavioni says that's a shame.
The canoe will die without having a sea life.
It's Students from nearby Lahaina Luna High School are building a full-on outrigger sailing canoe. 15-year-old Ika Palawatan wipes sawdust from her brow as she takes a break from sanding.
It's a lot of pride and honor to get back into the cultural history of the Hawaiian people, and to be a high school student and to be among all these master carvers is an amazing feeling. When we're eating dinner, eating lunch, they come up to us and ask us about how our canoe is going, and we kind of get off into the subject of how they live and their islands and what it's like to be them.
Palawatan says she hopes to get more of her cohorts into carving and to get this new canoe out on the water as much as possible. At the annual Parade of the Canoes, middle schoolers from local Maui Prep Academy wave and toss flowers from the hull of the boat made by the festival's Maori visitors. Master carver Hector Busby's canoe is 48 feet long and gleaming red, with an elaborately carved stern, bow, and gunwales. Per tradition, all the finished canoes are paraded through the streets of Lahaina before they make their maiden voyage. Maui Prep will inherit the Maori's boat. Faculty say they plan to make it the school's largest teaching tool. This makes Master Maori carver Hector Busby extremely happy.
Now the kids is going to paddle it, and that's what I like about it. That it's not going to sit, you know, it's going to be used.
After the ceremonial cutting of the umbilical cord, a leafy rope symbolically connecting the canoe to the ground, the carvers lift their vessels and push them bow first into the ocean. As they paddle, the former trees are finally transformed into canoes, perpetuating the Polynesian belief that nothing truly dies, especially tradition. For Only a Game, I'm Jesse Hardman in Lahaina, Hawaii.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Simon Wood and from Michael Havey at KUER in Salt Lake. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. Greetings this week go out to our newest member station, WBOI, Northeast Indiana Public Radio. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to see photos of German fans at the World Cup, read a review of Mad Seasons, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. In our final word this week, Bud Collins, Mr. Tennis himself, shows his reverence for the World Cup.
Oh, the old kickball tournament, yeah.
All right, that's it. I give up. If you people can't learn to love the beautiful game, you're on your own. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week. Maybe.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston and from the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities on the web at WKKF.org. The Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness on the web at MelvilleTrust.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with a new website at MacFound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.